Jamie turned and saw Dex's heart suit with its royal blue armbands nearly 100 meters away. He'd been eavesdropping on their suit-to-suit frequency. "There's always bilateral symmetry," Jamie said, trying to keep the resentment out of his voice. Trumbull laughed. Vijay added, "Something with legs would help." Bounding across the iron-red sand toward them, clutching a plastic sample case in one gloved hand, Dex said, "But that stuff about the ocean is good. I could use that in my VR tour. Give me a couple hours with the computer, and I could even show a visual simulation to the viewers back home." Dex was all youthful enthusiasm and vigor. Jamie felt distinctly annoyed. The geophysicist hustled up the slight rocky incline in 2-meter-long strides to where Jamie and Vijay stood. "It's really frost, all right. Look at it. Come on. I want to get some samples before the sun evaporates all of it." He hoisted the insulated sample case. Without waiting for Jamie, Trumbull started down the slope toward the frost-rimed dunes. Jamie clicked the keyboard on his left cuff to the suit radio's base frequency. "Waterman to base. Shekhtar, Trumbull, and I are going down into the dune field." Stacy Dejurova's answering voice sounded slightly nettled. "You will be out of camera range, Jamie." "Understood," Jamie said. "We should be no longer than 30 minutes, and we won't go beyond walkback range." Dejurova made a sound somewhere between a sigh and a snort. "Copy, 30 minutes max in walkback range." As senior of the two astronauts, Dejurova was responsible for enforcing the safety regulations. Her primary station was at the dome's communications center, watching everyone working outside through the surveillance cameras spotted around the dome. "I can understand why she's ticked off," Jamie thought. "We ought to be at the dome helping to stow the equipment and consumables instead of wandering off across the landscape." The others had both the small tractors trundling between their LAV and the dome. Still, he turned his back to the work and walked slowly beside Vijay, ready to offer his hand if she stumbled on the rocks scattered across the ground. His geologist's eye took in the area. "This must be a really old impact crater," he told himself. "Weathering on Mars takes eons, and this rim is almost eroded down to the level of the sand floor. Must have been a big hit from the size of the basin. What's left of it?" Trumbull was already down in the shadows, on his knees, carefully scraping the fragile paper-thin coating of ice into an open sample container. "It's water ice, all right," he was saying over the suit-to-suit frequency as they approached him. "Same isotopic composition as the ice at the North Pole, I bet. Stuff sublimes into vapor up there, and the atmosphere transports it down toward the equator." Vijay pointed with a gloved finger.
"It's melting where the sun is hitting it."
"Subliming," Trumbull said, without looking up from his work. "It doesn't melt, it sublimes." "Goes from ice to vapor," Jamie explained, "with no liquid phase in between."
"I understand," she replied.
"The atmosphere is so thin, liquid water evaporates immediately."
"Yes, I know,"
she said, with a slight edge in her voice. Trumbull snapped the container shut and inserted it into his sample case.
"This'll help us nail down the global circulation of the atmosphere."
"Will this water be carbonated, too?"
Closing the plastic box and climbing to his feet, Trumbull said,
"Sure. Just like the water from the permafrost underground. Martian Perrier, loaded with carbon dioxide."
Jamie started them back toward the base, feeling left out of the conversation, but not knowing how to jump in without making it seem obvious that he was competing with the younger man.
"Life has the same needs here as on Earth," Vijay was saying.
"Why not?"
Trumbull replied, waving his free hand.
"It's all the same, basically. DNA, proteins, same on both planets."
"But there are differences," Jamie said. "Martian DNA has the same double helix structure as ours, but the base pairs are different chemicals."
"Yeah, sure. And Martian proteins have a few different amino acids in them, but they still need water."
They had reached the crest of the rim rock. Jamie could see the camera atop its high, skinny pole peering at them.
"We'd better get back to the dome and help finish the unloading."
She answered,
"Yes, I suppose we should."
Jamie couldn't see Trumbull's face behind the heavily tinted visor of his helmet, but he heard the younger man laugh. Hefting his container box, Trumbull said,
"Well, some of us have important work to do. Have fun playing stevedores."
and he loped across the rock-strewn ground toward the base shelter, leaving Jamie and Shekhtar standing on the rim of the ancient crater. Virtual Tour, Sol 1. Later that afternoon, C. Dexter Trumbull was still excited as he clicked the two miniaturized VR cameras into the slots just above his visor. They were slaved to the movements of his eyes, if the electronics rig worked right. Together with the molecular-thin data gloves he had already wormed over his spacesuit gloves, he would be able to show the millions of viewers on Earth whatever he himself saw or touched. Briefly, he looked back at the rest of the crew, now carrying crates and bulky canisters through the dome's airlock. They would spend the rest of the day setting up equipment and making the dome livable. Trumbull's job was to entertain the people back home who were helping to pay for this expedition. The first expedition to Mars had been run by national governments and had cost nearly $250 billion. The second expedition was financed mostly by private sources and cost less than a tenth as much. Of course, the 6 years between the two missions had seen the advent of clipper ships, reusable spacecraft that brought down the cost of flying into orbit from thousands of dollars per pound to hundreds. Masterson Corporation and the other big aerospace firms had donated dozens of flights into Earth orbit to the Mars expedition. It was good public relations for them and their new clipper ships. And Dex's father had indeed spearheaded the drive that raised the money for the expedition. The elder Trumbull had personally donated nearly $500 million of his own wealth, then chivied, cajoled, or shamed fellow billionaires into contributing to the cause. But the real reason for the lower cost was that this second expedition was going to live off the land. Instead of carrying every gram of water, oxygen, and fuel all the way from Earth, they had sent automated equipment ahead of them to land on Mars and start producing water, oxygen, and fuel from the planet's atmosphere and soil. Dex Trumbull dubbed the procedure Plan Z after the engineer who had pioneered the concept decades earlier, Robert Zubrin. Still, even with Plan Z, the expedition ran into problems before its first module took off from Earth. Nuclear rockets would cut the travel time between Earth and Mars almost in half, but there was still so much controversy in the United States and Europe over using nuclear propulsion that the expedition planners moved the main launch site to the island nation of Kiribati out in the middle of the Pacific. There, the nuclear engines were launched into orbit on clipper ships to be mated with the living and equipment modules launched from the United States and Russia. Anti-nuclear demonstrators were not allowed within 200 miles of the island launch site. Kiribati's price for being so obliging was to have the expedition's mission control center established at their capital, Tarawa. Pete Connors, astronaut veteran of the first expedition, and the other controllers did not at all mind moving to the balmy atoll. And Kiribati got global attention for its fine hotels and tourist facilities and security. The biggest problem had been selection of the personnel to go to Mars. Two biologists and two geologists would be the entire scientific staff, and the competition among eager, intense young scientists was ferocious. Dex sometimes asked himself if he would have been selected as one of the geologists, even if his father had not been so munificent. "Doesn't matter," he always answered himself. "I'm on the team, and the rest of them can torque themselves inside out for all I care." Trumbull grimaced as he checked out the VR electronics with his head-up display. The diagnostic display flickered across his visor. Everything operational except the damned gloves. Their icon blinked red at him. The first law of engineering: when something doesn't work, kick it. As he jiggered the hair-thin optical fiber wires that connected the gloves to the transmitter on his backpack, Trumbull told himself once again that he was the only man on the team who understood the economics of this mission. And the economics determined what could or could not be accomplished. Waterman and the rest of the scientists always have their heads in the clouds, he thought. They're here to do science. They want to convert their curiosity into Nobel Prizes. Yeah, but unless somebody foots the frigging bills, they'd still be back on some campus on Earth, spending their nights chatting about Mars over the Internet. Hell, I want to do good science too, but the thing is, somebody's got to pay for all this. They look down on me because I'm the only realist in